Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The game of chess can help improve brain power. It's been doing so for a long, long time among myriad cultures. We'll be talking about chess history and how it's more than just a game in this segment. And why has St. Louis, home of the World Chess Hall of Fame, become such an important place in the chess universe? We have the right people with us to talk about it. Tony Rich is the executive director of the Chess Club and Scholastic Center of St. Louis. David Schenk is the author of The Immortal Game, A History of Chess, and he joins us by phone. Nice to have you both with us. David, thank you for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Tony, good to have you in studio. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Don.
David, I'd like to begin with you. It's a tough assignment because it's a long history, but can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the history of chess, when it got started and where?
Sure, 20 seconds or less.
Yeah.
1,400 years of chess history. It's a fascinating story, but the quick version is that it's about 1,500 years old, and we really can't be absolutely sure where it started, but it actually probably was invented along the old Silk Road routes, China, India, you know, that region of the world, and it probably wasn't invented in one specific time, but over time by the merchants who traveled those routes.
Okay, well, that is the thumbnail sketch of it. How much has it changed, do you think, since those early days?
Well, we know quite a bit about how it's changed. As of about 1,400 years ago, when it was adopted by Persia from India, it was very, very close to the current game. The only really substantial change that was made, and that was hundreds of years later in medieval Europe, was that the queen... the queen used to be basically the chief of staff and much less powerful. In medieval times in Europe, the queen, for actually known political reasons, became the most powerful piece on the board.
And why has it endured all these centuries, do you think?
Well, that's the question that I want to answer in my book. And again, there's lots to say about that. But really, the quick answer, the summary, is that chess is, there are two things to say. One is that it's very, very simple to learn, but essentially infinitely complex to play. You can play for 100 years, and you can play every day of those 100 years and never really explore all of its permutations. It's almost literally an infinite game of literally infinite possibility. And the second thing is, that it turns out to be a game that, while it's actually divorced from the real world, it lives in its own world intellectually, it teaches us so much about how to think about things in a representational way. And that type of representational thinking has turned out to be really instrumental throughout human history.
Tony, as you sit here nodding with everything that David has said so far, I'm sure you're right in accord with what he said about the game.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, David hit the nail on the head, especially whenever he speaks of the benefits of the game of chess. It's a game first and foremost, so it's an easy way to hide your vegetables and your ice cream, right? That kind of idea. You're able to teach students and adults these really complex topics like how to problem solve, how to plan ahead, understanding that an action right now might have consequences down the road as well. So we've seen students that participate in chess programs have improved attendance, improved behavior, better test scores, and directly attributable to chess.
You know, it's been my observation that some people are a lot better at chess than others. And I put myself in that category. I was never very good at it. My brother was outstanding, played people around the world. What are the qualities of a good chess player?
To answer that, I think I have to answer another question first. So I often get asked, is chess a sport? Is it a science? Is it an art? Like, how do you categorize this game, really? How does it all fit together? And the reason why that's so difficult to answer is because it's all of these things. There are elements of art. Whenever two chess players sit down, equally matched, and play a game against one another, you really can create some beautiful ideas across the board, or you can create some interesting concepts in the way you maneuver your pieces with your opponent. It also has some of that science element to it, especially as players prepare for their opponents. They'll look up databases of games and such. And, of course, you definitely have the sporting element as well, as we'll see here in St. Louis starting soon with the Sinkfield Cup. These competitors are just as tough and every bit as athletic in their capabilities as like a Rory McIlroy or a Jason Day or any of the other the big golf stars out there, right? So now to answer your question, I think a good chess player is someone who has the tenacity to be able to lose, suffer a defeat, but then to be able to go back and understand why, and to be able to build upon their knowledge and fill in those gaps, and eventually they become better chess players along the way.
David, what do you think about that? What makes a good chess player?
I agree with every word you said. I think we're going to have a lot of agreement here. Let me just throw in one or two historical anecdotes. When we're talking about chess being an artistic endeavor, not many people know probably that the great and profoundly important artist Marcel Duchamp, who really helped to invent the notion of abstract art, became so enamored of chess from an aesthetic point of view and an intellectual point of view that he actually ended up devoting a serious portion of his adult life to the game, and to outside observers, really gave up other art making, and decided for many, many years that playing his games of chess and also studying the end games and things like that, studying it, he wrote a beautiful, very, very abstract book about chess, studying all the ideas inherent in chess, that was such a powerful exploration of artistic ideas that for many, many years, that was enough for this great artist.
And you know, David's absolutely right. We have at the World Chess Hall of Fame, one of our current exhibitions is called Out of the Box, and it is an artistic representation by a gentleman named Tom Hackney of Marcel Duchamp's chess games. So he actually would go through the games that Marcel Duchamp played historically and create art based upon those games. And Marcel Duchamp's wife is known to have glued his chess pieces to his board because he was too passionate about chess and needed to focus on other things.
David, do you agree with me that that some people are better at it because of, you know, I'm not even sure what the way to describe this, because a certain brain development, some people are better at math and some people are better at composing paragraphs, the written language. Do you agree that there is a particular type that is better at it?
Well, I love how you put that question towards the end of the question, talking about it in terms of brain development, because a lot of people talk about strength at chess and, frankly, lots of other disciplines as being something that's, you know, an innate gift or not. I ended up following my book on chess with a whole book inspired by some of the research I saw in my research on chess about how talent and strengths in all these different domains actually are about development. The life experience you have, the love you have in your life, and where you choose to spend your time, the type of mentors you have. But you're absolutely right. Of course, every human has strengths and weaknesses that develop over time, according to their life experience, and it is a particular set of things that attract certain people and certain personalities to chess. The bottom line is, if you actually want to get really good at chess, it requires like any serious discipline, like music, art, like sports, anything. It requires an extraordinary, extraordinary amount of time, sacrifice, devotion, discipline. You really can't play it casually and just kind of fall into being extraordinary at the game.
That goes back to Gladwell's 10,000 hours, I suspect, that if you want to be good at anything, you've got to devote that kind of time.
Indeed, and I'm not as well known as Gladwell, but my book was written around the same time as his stuff, so we studied the same research on all that, yes.
But you know, Don, one of the great paradoxes about the game of chess is you have some folks who just seem to display a lot of natural talent, a lot of affinity for the game. But then you also have the folks who work really hard and are able to become better and better at the game as well. Just to give a couple of examples, Jose Raul Capablanca, who was a world champion at the game of chess, was known for spending his wee hours of the morning playing card games and maybe sitting down at the hotel bar instead of preparing for his next game. But he's an example of somebody who had a lot of that natural talent, could just sit down and seem to play really well from the beginning. But then other other world champions like Botvinnik or Garry Kasparov himself, these guys, not only did they have natural talent, obviously, to become world champion, but they worked doggedly. They prepared, they turned the game into a science and really figured out how to master it.
David, St. Louis has become something of a hotspot for the game. Am I saying that only because I'm here in St. Louis and we talk about it a lot, or do you view it that way from afar?
No. St. Louis is famous, even to us New Yorkers, and you could go probably anywhere in the world if you're talking about chess, and people have heard of it because so much important stuff around chess goes on there. I do want to just quickly say, and I don't want to divert the conversation, I know it would be a whole different hour, but I do want to say for listeners out there, I strongly disagree with that specific point about natural talent. I think talent is widely misunderstood, and yes, it can look natural. It can look like it was you were born with it. It was innate. But really, when you pick apart natural talent, and I swear to God, I won't say anything more about it, but when you pick it apart, what we think natural talent is, it's really early development. And I wrote a whole book about that, so I promise not to revisit that, but just to put that idea out there.
David, I'm going to have to read that one then.
We're going to be talking about early childhood development and developing the brain, if you will, in the next segment of this program.
Terrific.
Tony, let me come back to you. Why St. Louis? Why has St. Louis become this kind of mecca for chess?
Well, you know, St. Louis does have a very rich history when it comes to the game of chess. In fact, the first world championship ever held in 1886 was in three major U.S. cities, New York, St. Louis, and New Orleans. So dating back to those days of 1886, you could find the world champions right here in this town. In fact, just down the street from the studios here, playing chess. But as far as the recent resurgence of chess in St. Louis, I think a big part of that is because of the Chess Club and Scholastic Center of St. Louis, our founder, Rex and Jeannie Sinkfield. They had the vision and the resources really necessary to be able to show what chess could be to an American audience. Now, chess is very popular in Europe, much more popular than it is in the United States. But we're seeing that come to a much closer equilibrium, especially with the advent of the internet. Players have the ability to face each other online, play somebody from Bulgaria or Turkey or any other country around the world. And it's becoming really this universal game thanks to the internet as well.
David, I've always thought of Russia as being the epicenter in the chess world.
Well, chess has been a very, very popular game in Russia way, way before America existed. So, yes, it has a very deep history there, going back, let's say, 800 or 1,000 years, that kind of thing. But, that's the amazing thing about chess, and the thing that really drew me to write a whole book about it, is that chess infects people wherever it goes. And it infects people of all ages. And you really can't find not only any other game, you really cannot find any other idea or language or currency or food or anything that is that infectious, that wherever it goes, it takes hold and it grabs people's imaginations and it just doesn't let go.
As a very quick aside here, and I have to take a break, let me just ask, do you think the chess and the history that it's had in Russia in any way informed and has informed its politics?
Well, you'd have to, that's a bit above my pay grade in terms of my knowledge of Russian history, but I can say for sure that wherever chess goes, it becomes, it finds its way to many of the great minds. It ends up being used as a metaphor for politics and war and all sorts of other ideas. I can't really give you a concrete example of how it is, how it has influenced the history of Russia, but I'm sure that it's been integrally involved.
That's David Shank. He is the author of The Immortal Game, A History of Chess. He is joining us by phone. Tony Rich is in studio with me. He is the executive director of the Chess Club and Scholastic Center of St. Louis. Obviously, we're talking about chess, and we will continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our guest, David Shank, author of The Immortal Game, A History of Chess, and Tony Rich, the executive director of the Chess Club and Scholastic Center of St. Louis. Tony, let me turn to you. You wanted to add something with regard to the Russian connection to the game.
Yeah, I think it is an interesting observation that Russia historically has dominated the game of chess, but within the past maybe 10 or 15 years, We've really seen kind of, maybe it's a blossoming of chess in Western parts of Europe and the United States. And the shift has really gone away from, or the focus away from Russia. The example that I'll give for that is coming up, in fact, starting this end of this week, we have an event called the Sinkfield Cup. It's the Chess Club and Scholastic Center of St. Louis. It's our largest major international tournament, featuring 10 players who are all among the top 10 in the world, $300,000 prize fund. And the Sinkfield Cup is just one of four tournaments that are a part of the Grand Chess Tour. So these 10 players kind of travel around the world over the year, and they play across these tournaments to ultimately be crowned the winner of the Grand Chess Tour. It's interesting to note that of the 10 players in the Sinkfield Cup, only one of them is Russian. Mm-hmm. We have a Bulgarian player. We have a player from India. We have three players from the United States. So it really is kind of a cross-section of the world, not just of Russian dominance of the game any longer.
You know, my brother, as I mentioned earlier, was an active chess player. He played all over the world by postcard back in the days when that was the way it was done. But now I guess that competition is online when people who want to play other folks around the world.
That's right. Correspondence chess is still a popular version of the game that's played today. Some folks still do mail each other their postcards, but for the most part, it happens online.
You know, the names that you've mentioned who are competing here in St. Louis and other names that have been mentioned earlier in the program of outstanding players from around the world, we're all men. Where are the women in this game?
I'm glad you brought that up, actually. It's a great question. Because within the chess world, it is a male-dominated sport. I think historically, one of the reasons that maybe David has some other insights into this, but it seems that it is a sport that was taught from father to son, and therefore the game perpetuated as being kind of a male-dominated sport. That's not to say that women cannot be great chess players. In fact, women like Judit Polgar from Hungary or Haoyu Fan from China, these are women who have really kind of broken that glass ceiling of the chess world and shown that it is equal competition between men and women. I think just statistically, since there are more men that play chess, you tend to find more men who end up becoming good at chess. But that's shifting more and more as the game becomes more gender equal.
David, do you have any insight into that part of the game?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with that assessment entirely. Historically, chess is has been a game that is associated with fierce contests. It's got this military kind of overlay. And it's a highly competitive and highly intellectual game, and of course we now know that women are every bit as competitive and every bit as intellectual as men. But historically, that's just not the way. You know, that's just not the history of what history has done for men and women. It's men have had the power. Men have tended to congregate in those domains and control them. And so that's just, you know, the simple historical explanation. There are some marvelous women chess players. In fact, Judit Polgar is one of just three sisters who all of them are extraordinary chess players. And the best part of that story is that their father said publicly before he had any kids that he was going to create a whole family of extraordinary chess players, and he actually achieved that strange if wonderful goal.
As an interesting tie into St. Louis as well, one of those three sisters, Susan Polgar, runs the Webster University chess program, which is by far the best collegiate chess program historically, at least within the past number of years. She brings grandmasters from all over the world. The university provides scholarships for the students to be able to learn. And at the same time, we get to see some amazing chess in St. Louis at the university level as well.
Susan is a fantastic person and a great ambassador for chess, no doubt.
This resurgence, if I can put it that way, really it goes back just a couple of years. It's always been a popular game, been around a long time.
Right.
But what has happened in the last couple of years to give it this upward push?
So in the recent timeline, I would say the primary mover would have been the launch of the Chess Club and Scholastic Center of St. Louis. I mentioned Dr. Jeannie Sinkfield and Rex Sinkfield having founded the club in 2008. Mm-hmm. We opened our doors, and I was surprised at how quickly the chess club was adopted into the St. Louis community. I had this vision that it would one day be seen like the Science Center or the Art Museum or any of the other institutional nonprofit organizations that exist here in our great city. it happened much more quickly than I thought. In fact, we have 1,000 members at the chess club now. We have regular programming for kids and adults alike. Grandmasters are always in the club playing games, studying, helping with private lessons and those kinds of things. So I would say that the club opening would have been probably the first mover. The World Chess Hall of Fame moving to St. Louis shortly after that as well. And now we're seeing more and more adoption. And I think we've reached that critical mass where St. Louis will, for the foreseeable future, be one of the prime movers in the chess world.
We've talked earlier about how the internet has changed the way people play it around the world. You used to do it by postcard. Now they're doing it online. We have a caller here from O'Fallon. That would be Jerry, who wants to talk about the former method of playing around the world. Go ahead, Jerry. You're on the air.
Yes, I've always thought it fascinating. The late actor Humphrey Bogart was apparently a correspondence chess player. I read an interview done with him, I guess, back in the 40s, and I just cannot imagine the ability to contain all these various games, you know, and several in a day get a move and respond with a counter move. that just boggles my mind. So that's my only comment.
Dan, it's an amazing talent that a lot of these grandmasters have. In fact, there is a variant of chess called blindfold chess, where the players play with outside of the board. They can identify where the pieces are, keep track of them in their memory, and keep going. Some chess players can play multiple boards blindfolded at the same time, and that's called a blindfold simul. In fact, there's an American chess player named Timur Gurayev who is attempting to break the world record, which will be 64 blindfold simultaneous games, keeping track of 64 different positions, all of the tactics and combinations leading to checkmate, and he'll probably win most of those games is the interesting point.
It's mind-boggling to think that someone could actually do that. David, I wanted to get back to you on one issue that we haven't touched upon that many people are familiar with, and that is, no pun intended here, that chess is kind of a pawn in the Cold War, that there have been a lot of instances over the course of the last 50, 60, 70 years in which that has played a Cold War role.
Well, it sure has. It's a really fascinating part of the history. And chess has been used politically many, many times over its 1,400 years history. But yes, you're right. In the Cold War, the quick summary is that Russia, which, as has already been discussed, kind of had a head start on us, had, a lot of really extraordinary chess players. And when we were at our most competitive with Russia, or when they were at our most competitive with us, I should say, and just were looking for any possible advantage, they put a lot of state resources into training their people. So they loved those kind of public humiliations where we'd go head to head with them and they would best us. And for many years they did. And probably many, many listeners are still familiar with the great tournament of Bobby Fischer in the early 70s, where he just had this extraordinary victory. And it was it brought the world's attention to the game, and really was this signal moment where Russians were humiliated at a game that they had so dominated for such a long time.
And it's actually really interesting to think about that particular match, the 72 World Championship match, as kind of a microcosm of what was happening geopolitically between the U.S. and the USSR at the time. It goes to show just how important it was for the American political leaders to be dominant in chess, just to prove that the USSR did not have a stranglehold on that. Henry Kissinger himself called Bobby Fischer to encourage him to keep the match going and to win.
And that was just a few years after Van Cliburn humiliated the Russians at the piano.
That's right.
At the Tchaikovsky exhibition. One final question. Tony, I'll go to you first. You alluded to this earlier on. There's a debate as to whether or not this game is a game or a sport. What is it?
It's all of the above. And, I think it's up to the listeners to decide for themselves. And if they want to find out, they can come down to the Chess Club and Scholastic Center. We're right in the Central West End at the corner of Euclid and Maryland. I mentioned the Sinkfield Cup happening over the next 2 weeks. Big international tournament. Amazing grandmaster commentary, very ESPN-style play-by-play action. And if they can't make it down in person, they can check out all the action at grandchesstour.org.
David, game or sport?
Well, I absolutely agree with that answer. And let me just put it a slightly different way, and that is that for me, chess is a beautiful human game. And it's funny to say that now because there are obviously all these computers out there that can play it so well they can beat just about anyone. And we use computers to train the great players. But in the end, this is a beautiful game between two people. And it's very, very physical. It's obviously very intellectual. It involves incredible creativity. When you're sitting at the board physically with the other person, you are interacting with that person many times wordlessly, but still, you're exchanging a lot of information, a lot of emotion, and it really is just it can be just the most beautiful interaction between two human minds.
I think the great American chess player, Grandmaster Gata Kamsky, probably said it most eloquently when he said, two chess players sitting at a board are like two conductors sitting in front of their own symphonies, and they're responsible for conducting their symphony. If they're out of tune, or maybe if they aren't in harmony with one another, it's not very beautiful. But when those two conductors are able to make that one game, able to produce this one thing that is in harmony and beautiful and sounds great together, that is what beauty in chess is.
Does it have a future in the Olympics?
Who knows? Hope so.
What do you think, David?
I can tell you this. I don't think any of us can predict what people will be talking about or playing or eating in 1,000 years, but I would put everything I've got that people will still be playing chess, either the exact same game we play now or something very, very close. And that's, the through line is for me one of the remarkable stories of the game.
I want to thank you both so much, Tony Rich and David Shank, for being with us for this discussion on chess. A fascinating subject indeed. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.